This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We're sitting down today with Mara Liasson. She's a national political correspondent for NPR and a contributor to Fox News. Regular listeners will often hear her stories and reports on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. She covers politics and policy from Washington, D.C., focusing on the White House and Congress, and also reports on national political trends. She's in town for a few days because last year she was named a Florida Gulf Coast University Presidential Fellowship Scholar. While she's here, she'll be meeting journalism students on campus to talk about First Amendment issues. Plus, she'll meet with the WGCU news team members tomorrow evening, and she will also be meeting with the public at the Hilton in Naples. So we've brought her into our studio to get to know her a little bit better and explore how her job as a political journalist and correspondent has changed over her more than 30-year career. Mara Liasson, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you in studio, and also a little bit surreal. I'll go ahead and say it out loud.
As always, usually I'm in your headphones, but not sitting across the table from you.
No kidding. Yeah. We want to also invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So you're in town as a Presidential Fellowship Scholar for FGCU. What does that role mean?
Well, that's a good question because I am the first one and this is my first day being one. And the way this happened was last year I came down to do what is a pretty standard station visit for NPR reporters. We come to a local station, we spend time with the staff, maybe help fundraise, give a public speech. Mm-hmm. That's what I did. And at that public speech, Mike Martin, the president of the university, came up to me and said, "I have an idea. You're going to be the first presidential fellow at Florida Gulf Coast University." And I said, "Okay." And we worked out an arrangement. I'm going to be coming down here twice a year, every year as long as he'll have me, maybe in perpetuity, and doing much more with students. That's the big difference. Today I went to a class. I did a pledge drive here. Now I'm talking to you. I'm going to do another class tonight. I'm going to meet with the staff here. Tomorrow I have a bunch of classes I'm going to talk to, and I think I'm going to critique some of the students' capstone projects. That's, I think, upper-level journalism majors mm-hmm. do a big project for their senior year. And I'm going to give the public talk, as you mentioned. So that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it twice a year.
So it's kind of exciting. You get to work with journalism students.
Oh, super exciting.
At a pretty critical time.
Yes, at a very critical time. And anyway, it's great. I'm thrilled to have this opportunity.
Well, we're excited to have you around. Every time I meet another journalist, I feel like I have to ask this question. Why? Why did you decide to become a journalist?
Why did I decide to become a journalist? I was very interested in history and politics and current events and writing. And I was an American history major in college. And I just loved it. It doesn't feel like work to me, like drudgery. There's nothing about it. It's super intellectually engaging. I feel like I'm able to be involved with the most important issues facing the country, like every single day. So I'm really thrilled with what I ended up doing. I did start out working for a newspaper, but I've been at NPR for a very long time, for 34 years.
So did you always feel a pull to report on politics?
When I came to NPR, I was a newscaster. Then I was a general assignment reporter. And then I covered Congress. And in 1992, I was assigned to Bill Clinton's presidential campaign. And there is a tradition in journalism. It's not a hard and fast rule. But sometimes when you cover the winner, you get to go to the White House and become the White House correspondent.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
Because you already have a bunch of sources. And so that's what I did. So when he won, I became the White House correspondent for all 8 years of the Clinton administration. And then when he left office, I became the national political correspondent, which I have been since 2000. I'm still in the White House rotation. But I'm not – I'm the national political correspondent. I am not a White House correspondent. My colleagues are, so they do all the foreign travel with the president. I don't do that.
Oh, that's nice because that would be quite a slog.
Yeah, and also every other year I'm covering campaigns.
Mm-hmm. So if you are covering a campaign and the person does not win, do you still get to go to Washington? Well, because now you're the
– Well, it depends. That's really up to the news organization.
Okay.
But in my case, I was covering Congress. I got assigned to Clinton. He won. I moved to the White House. There were plenty of Arkansas reporters who covered Clinton who came to Washington to cover him mm-hmm. after he won.
Maybe ended up staying, I would imagine.
Staying, absolutely. Yeah. Ron Fournier is a perfect example who came and worked for the AP. Mm-hmm. He had covered Clinton in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, politics is kind of a dirty word.
Yes. As I always say, politics comes from the Greek word meaning polis, which means many, and tix, which means blood-sucking insects.
Well, it's kind of like a role-playing for people who are like vying for power. And I'm wondering, how much does political posturing get in the way of actually making policy and laws that benefit the country?
Well, it gets
Do you find people get there and like get disillusioned with the amount of politics?
Well, first of all, politics – I know politics is a dirty word, and I know people are frustrated and think it's all just a big game because I think they're disappointed in the fact that the people they elect, politicians, aren't solving the big problems that need to be solved in America. However, politics is the nonviolent way that we work out our differences and that we govern ourselves. So politics is really important. Yes, there's a lot of posturing. Yes, there's a lot of gamesmanship. But in all these years, I have never become cynical about it because it's really important. It's how we govern ourselves. And I think that most members of Congress take their job seriously. There are tremendous forces making it harder for them to find big bipartisan solutions to problems. Sometimes it's a matter of political will. In other words, sometimes all that stuff you're talking about, the posturing and gamesmanship gets in the way. But other times things happen that they feel are beyond their control. I mean, just for an example, when I started covering Congress 34 years ago, there was a tremendous overlap between the two parties. In other words, there were conservative Democrats. Sorry.
Yes,
and there were moderate to liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. And the overlap between those two groups defined the political center. That's where compromises got made and bipartisan deals got made. Over time, the two parties have become much more ideologically coherent, which is actually bad for democracy. There's not much overlap. The Republicans first moved much more to the right. The Democrats now are doing the same thing, moving to the left. So that makes it harder to have a compromise.
And well, when you mentioned earlier, it's the peaceful way of getting things done. But we've had a lot of politically motivated violent activity from certain people who, as you mentioned, people get frustrated when things don't happen. And with that polarization, extreme Democrat and extreme Republican, you've got people that are frustrated with it and then following through with less political and more of a violent like –
You're thinking about what? Just give me some examples.
The man who just was recently found guilty of running his car into a protest.
Like in Charlottesville.
Yes, that was yesterday.
Or the Coast Guard lieutenant who was arrested for allegedly plotting attacks on a bunch of media figures and, and politicians. Then there was the pipe bomber also arrested for allegedly I think he just pled guilty. Yeah.
And also on the other side, the guy that shot up the
Yes, the Bernie Sanders supporter who shot up the congressional softball practice. Yes. Most of the acts of political violence in the last 20 or 30 years have been from the right. That doesn't mean they're the only examples. But most of the acts of terrorism, in other words, there have been acts Islamic radically inspired terrorism. But most of the acts of political violence that we've seen in the last 20 years or so have been from the right.
Yeah. And is it something that you hear people talking about in Washington that they need to get it together so that these things aren't happening as often?
I don't hear a huge discussion of that. There was recently a big article in the New York Times Magazine about why that kind of violence isn't – or that kind of domestic terrorism isn't taken as seriously as other kinds. But no, it's not a big topic of discussion. I think that now that the Democrats are back in power in the House, maybe they'll be looking into it. But no, I don't see that being talked about a lot. It is chilling though when people feel that they have to – that is the expression of their political beliefs because one of the hallmarks of a strong democratic capitalist system is that we have a peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah, and that leads me to another question. We were talking earlier about your involvement with Fox News as a commentator.
Mm-hmm. I've been on Fox for 20 years and I've been at NPR for 35,
and 34. I'm wondering, does it ever concern you or make you fearful the anger that people are feeling towards journalists who are telling a truth that they may not agree with?
Absolutely. Look, When you go to a Trump rally and see a guy wearing a T-shirt that says, "Rope, tree, journalist, some assembly required," that's chilling. Now, or recently BBC cameraman was roughed up at a Trump rally and the crowd was cheering on his attacker. You know, those things are chilling. Sure, of course it worries me. The list of people on the pipe bomber's target list, the guy who just pled guilty, a lot of them were journalists, journalists who Donald Trump had singled out. And I'm not connecting him to this attack, but I'm just saying they were on the list. There's no doubt that there's a lot of anger in our society, a lot of polarization. Yes, there's political violence. But, you know, journalists have to keep on doing their jobs.
That's kind of what I thought you might say. I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to be scared out of doing what I love to do.
Yeah.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with NPR national political correspondent and Fox News contributor Mara Liasson. If you'd like to ask her a question or make a comment, please give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I want to wander into some additionally heavy territory. Back when you and I first started news, there was a thing called the Fairness Doctrine. There weren't 24-hour news stations, and the entire media landscape, you know, had a little bit less gray area. Do you feel like 24-hour news cycle TV and stations with clearly slanted presentations of news are responsible for the erosion of trust in journalists?
I think that they are definitely part of it. I think it's impossible to put the genie back in the bottle. I think that the Fairness Doctrine, which came the end of the Fairness Doctrine, which happened in the mid-80s, the Fairness Doctrine used to require that news organizations, broadcast operations, aired both sides of the story. It was kind of an enforced fairness.
Mm-hmm.
Once that was gone, you could have partisan-leaning, news organizations, MSNBC and Fox. And the joke is they don't even cover the same natural disasters. That's how polarized the media is.
Mm-hmm.
But the media in many eras of American history was extremely partisan. And, you know, you'd pick up the Democratic paper or the Republican paper in the 19th century. You know, you mm-hmm. knew what you were reading, but you were getting a purely partisan point of view. That changed. And I think, interestingly enough, in the middle of the 20th century, which I consider to be kind of the golden era of democratic capitalism, there were many terrible things that were happening there then. But we had the strongest middle class, the least amount of economic inequality, and we had more bipartisan consensus. The two parties back then were kind of fighting it out at the 50-yard lines. They weren't ideologically coherent coalitions. They were incoherent. Like I said, there were conservative Democrats and moderate Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think not coincidentally, we had three broadcast networks and everyone went home at 6 o'clock and turned on the news and more or less heard the same set of facts from which they could form their opinions. Now we start with our opinions and backfill a few conveniently cherry-picked facts, and that's our civic debate. So yes, there's no doubt that the end of the Fairness Doctrine contributed to this.
And it's interesting because the Fairness Doctrine came to be as radio dominated and TV was coming on the scene. I mean, that was right there in that middle part of the century. And it went away in the late 80s again. There have been hearings at the Capitol and, you know, inquiries by Congress about the responsibility of non-governmental entities like social media and the internet. So do you foresee Congress trying to legislate balance, fairness, and honesty in reporting going forward when it comes to the different kinds of media that are just now coming out?
I believe that Congress will regulate the big technology companies, including the social media aspect of that. How they'll do it, I don't know. They're not just neutral platforms. They are publishers. I think we've established – that has been established. Facebook now is trying to do something about – I think what did they just announce? They were not going to allow white nationalist content on their feed. But there will be regulation. I don't know what form it will take. But the problem is really deep because it's the business model of social media to promote extreme content. In other words, the algorithms of social media are designed to feed you extreme content because it's their business model. They know that the more extreme the content is, the longer people stay on watching it, the more advertisement they can sell. That's just the way it works. If you are a Civil War buff and you cruise around the internet looking for information on the Civil War, on battlefields, etc., sooner or later you're going to get some pro-Confederate, white nationalist content in your feed. That's how the algorithm works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even deeper than the social media algorithm for content. It's the phone itself. I read a description recently that was perfect. It was the iPhone is almost as if science invented a pill that allowed us to fly. In other words, it allows us access to all knowledge in the universe. It allows women to work from home, et cetera, et cetera. But it also gave us delusion, made us isolated, and gave a bunch of us ADHD. I mean, that's – you know, these things are very hard to reverse.
It's also kind of limited the ability of people to actually do their own research. And you just assume Google's going to get you the article that you want. No offense to Google. But I do love the immediate gratification of how tall is Harrison Ford? I wonder. And you can find out right now.
Well, you can find out. At least maybe you can find out what Harrison Ford put on his Wikipedia page.
There you go. You know, so you don't really know how vetted and how fact-based it is. It's even something as, you know – benign as that. We have a call on the line from Patrick from Naples who has a question. Patrick, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, I was curious. When, you know, given the different political leanings of the two networks that you are part of, do you find any pressure, either internal or external, to sort of slant your position based on those political leanings when you're on one versus the other?
That's an excellent question. And I think that I make it a point to never say anything on Fox that I wouldn't say on NPR and vice versa. And as a matter of fact, that's also NPR's rules for people like me who appear on television. In other words, our regular job is working for NPR, and many of us appear on TV in one capacity or another. And one of the guidelines, and you know, I already was doing it before they established these, but to never say anything anywhere else that you wouldn't say on NPR. I think that's a pretty simple guideline. But no, I've never felt pressure from either Fox or NPR to say anything, slant anything, period. Never.
Does that answer your question, Patrick?
It does. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for calling in. I think it would be almost like being willing to take sniper fire, though, going on a program like on a Fox News program. Do you feel like you're being attacked sometimes by other commentators?
No. First of all, just to make it really clear, the programs that I'm on Fox, I'm on Fox Special Report with Brett Baer. It was Brit Hume before him. That is a very – what I would almost call a traditional news program. He does the news of the day and then he has a panel of journalists, at three of us at the end, discussing the news. I'm an analyst. I'm not a pundit. I'm not an opinion columnist. I'm occasionally on Howie Kurtz's show, Media Buzz, which is kind of a media show. I used to be on Fox News Sunday a lot. That's also what I call a traditional show. Chris Wallace is the host. So the two or three places I appear on Fox to me are similar to shows anywhere. Maybe there are more conservative journalists on the panels, but I'm not on Hannity. I never was on O'Reilly. I'm not on the what I would call the more opinion side of Fox.
The ones that bicker a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've never felt attacked ever.
I want to go back to social media. I think it's really interesting in this conversation because you have people that feel like they're exercising their First Amendment rights as an individual, but the platform itself, you mentioned earlier, is basically a publisher. Right? So it's a big platform, though, because you're tweeting and you then amplify your message. Is controlling that going to be like putting toothpaste back in the tube? Is there any way to control it?
Well, certainly there is, because Twitter does ban people and social media does do some kind of policing. I mean, the fact that Facebook is now saying that they're not going to have white nationalist content on. However, this whole question of the First Amendment is a real thorny one because there is the First Amendment. And then there's yelling fire in a crowded theater. In other words, we recognize and there is something called hate speech. I mean, you know, we as a society have tried to set up rules and standards for having freedom of speech. It's the First Amendment. It's number one. At the same time, We don't want to encourage tremendous amounts of speech that erode democratic norms. Now, a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder. And the other thing about democracy, and I think we're all getting a crash course in what democracy is, a stable democratic system depends on restraint. Just because you can do or say something, you don't do or say anything that you feel like. And a lot of the restraint has to come from community norms, people's own self-restraint, and that's a really tricky area, how you set the standards and where you set the limits.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned self-restraint, and my very next question is about the most prolific tweeter-in-chief that I'm sure you're keenly aware is President Trump. I understand this morning when you got to the station, your first order of business to see what he was tweeting about. How odd is it to be looking at the Twitter feed of the leader of the country to find out what his mood is, who he's mad at that day, or what's going on?
Well, what's really interesting, and I'm kind of going to pull up his feed right now. What's really interesting about it is I don't believe that Donald Trump's Twitter feed is any different than Donald Trump's official pronouncements or comments in an interview. This is just another platform way that he expresses himself to the public, talks to his supporters, expresses his opinions. So the big difference is that Donald Trump is the most accessible president we've ever had and that his psyche is completely accessible. We know what he's thinking and feeling within seconds of him thinking and feeling it because he's either told us in a press scrum or he's posted it on Twitter. So you know, this morning, as usual, his Twitter feed is full of grievances and comments on cable news and what cable channels are doing well and what aren't and who's fake and who's not. Generally, fake news is an epithet he uses for negative stories about him. But it's not odd. It's just a feature of this president. I mean, Clinton used to use the town hall format. You know, Barack Obama had his own YouTube channel, and Donald Trump has Twitter.
I mean, I'm wondering though if that's accessibility or just monologuing and campaigning.
Well, it's both. It's monologuing, it's campaigning, but it makes him accessible. We know what he's thinking about because we know what's on his mind. And one of his big, you know, it's usually a grievance of one sort or another.
Yeah, it's usually not. Boy, it's a beautiful day outside.
No, although there is, I should recommend this to your listeners, there is a wonderful parody account called Nice Donald Trump.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
It actually is really sweet and funny. You know, like for instance, 4 hours ago, my only thoughts this week are of the people in the Midwest affected by historic flooding.
Oh, things that you'd like to have a president.
Yeah. That's very funny. Yeah, it's really, you know, I recommend it.
I'm going to follow that for sure.
Yeah.
Do you remember the times before you were connected to your phone all the time?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you ever get to disconnect?
Yes, I do. I do. I just went on vacation with my kids and I read a novel or I'm reading a novel. So that was very exciting.
It's great to read more than 240 characters or however many the tweet is.
Yes, I think that's really, really important. And so I do try to disconnect.
I found when I have disconnected and I come back, it's pretty much the same story.
Oh, yeah.
There's not a whole lot that actually happened. Yeah. There's been a lot of talking.
Yeah. What do they say about congressional hearings? Kind of everything's been said, but not every member of Congress has gotten to say it yet.
Yeah.
That's why the hearing is still going on.
Or the new incredible visual aids that they're having with the big poster board.
Right.
Liar, liar, pants on fire had to be my favorite thing. That had to be fun. How much time do you actually spend at the White House?
Well, we have four people in the White House rotation, me, the national political correspondent, and three White House correspondents. Right now we're down one because Scott Horsley, wonderful reporter, moved over to be the economics reporter because our economics reporter, John Itzde, retired. So we're down one. We're going to have four. We will have four. But right now there's three of us, Tam Keith, me, and Ayesha Rasko. So the way it works is we're supposed to take turns. Theoretically, one of us is there every day, so every third or fourth week, it's my turn to be at the White House. Our working space at the White House is very small. It's like a phone booth, so only one of us can be there at a time. Huh. So the other two people are back at headquarters working. So I would say probably I spend a third of my time at the White House.
So what's all happening at the White House if the president's not there?
Oh, well, if the president isn't there, you can try to go and find people to talk to. That's sometimes it's good when the president isn't there.
Because
it's easier
busy
to do that. But when the president isn't there, everybody else is there. So Sometimes if the president isn't there, the person who's weakest at the White House will come back and work in headquarters.
So I'm wondering about, you know, we always hear about the palace intrigue, you know, and the high drama. How mm-hmm. different is the mood at the White House now from previous administrations?
Much more drama. Remember, Obama was no drama Obama. Mm-hmm. Trump is chaos all the time. And tremendous backbiting, tremendous insecurity, tremendous infighting. What I have been told over and over again by people is whatever you have heard about it, it's worse. These are people who work inside, mm-hmm. you know, or who are close, you know, advisors to him. That's what they'll say. It's worse than – it's even worse than you think. So lots and lots of backbiting and infighting and mistrust.
That's a lot of pressure to work with every single day.
It's a lot of pressure. You know, every White House – the character of every White House is determined by the president at the time. President Obama was cerebral, calm. He you know, no drama Obama was not a joke. The downside of that was that his White House was very closely held. The joke was three people run the country. But there was – they did – the Obama White House team did like each other, respect each other, and there wasn't a lot of this. Trump likes chaos. He said that he likes to have his advisors pitted against each other. He is a fighter and a counterpuncher. He believes in that. That's kind of his modus operandi. He says that he likes the fact that so many of the people working for him are acting, you know, acting members of acting cabinet secretaries, et cetera. He likes that. That is the way he operates. And also he is a party of one in many ways. He likes to be his own press secretary. There are no press briefings to speak of. There's very, very few of them. He likes to be his own communications advisor. So he that's the way he likes to do it. And you know, what he said that he'd run the White House the way he ran his business. And he was in the reality TV business. And he has run his White House that way. He kind of sees every day as a television show that he's producing and he's the star and he's fighting against his enemies and hopefully vanquishing them. This last week for him was a very successful week in the Trump show because he prevailed in his telling against Robert Mueller, even though we haven't seen the report yet. But so that's how he wants it. That's how he thrives.
It's interesting. You just naturally progressed to my next question. I mentioned at the top of the show about the current situation in Washington, and the Mueller report just wrapped up. We have a summary of its contents. Is there a plan for the entire content to be made public? Do you think that's going to happen?
84% or 82 to 84% in various polls of Americans believe the report should be released in its entirety. Congress wants – the House of Representatives, the Democratic House wants that. They want the report, which we've been told is about 300 pages. They want all the underlying materials. Obviously, some of them would be redacted for sources and methods, things that are national security issues mm-hmm. or intelligence issues. They want Mueller to testify. They've told Attorney General Bob Barr to have the report to them by April 2nd. That's not going to happen. He said it's going to take weeks to get it organized. We do have a four-page summary from Bill Barr explaining what he said the Mueller report was. Very, very few quotes. The one thing he did quote from Mueller was that although Mueller did not find that the president obstructed justice or find evidence of that or find enough evidence of that, quote, he also did not exonerate him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Barr himself, as the Attorney General, has said that he does not believe that the president obstructed justice and will not be pursuing that. Congress has its own powers in that regard if they wanted to go forward and pursue that. But before that happens, the big fight is going to be over making the Mueller report public. It's unclear how strongly the White House will resist that. The president himself has said it's up to Barr, but I would be perfectly happy for the whole report to come out. That's kind of the way he said all along, I'd be perfectly happy to sit down for an interview with Bob Mueller. Mm-hmm. But it's really up to my lawyers. So
just
probably,
like his tax records we're not going to see because he's under an audit.
Which allegedly. We don't think he is. We've never seen any evidence that he was under an audit. So although presidents are always under – every president's tax returns are always audited.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a big fight. And recently Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, Republican, barred a vote in the Senate on making the report public. So that's the next battle. I find it hard to believe that this report will stay secret forever. A four-page summary of a 300-page report is not going to be the end of this. Now, it's possible that the report itself will not contradict that summary, won't add much to it. But I think the American people paid for this. and they seem to feel that they have a right to see it.
I mean, obviously it's different subject matter, but there was the Ken Starr investigation during the Clinton administration. How would you compare the release of information from that administration to this?
That report – okay, Ken Starr was operating under a different system. He was an independent counsel. He reported to a three-judge panel, and he was obligated by law to present his report – to write a report and present it to Congress, which he did.
Okay. So that's
how
that
different.
Was set up.
Yes. The special counsel law lapsed. Now we have this situation where Mueller was appointed by the Justice Department. The idea was that special counsel is supposed to be impervious to political influence. So you had the ironic – situation where the special counsel, who is supposed to be impervious to political influence, gave a report to a political appointee, Attorney General Barr, who then took it upon himself to absolve the president of obstruction of justice charges and so far to release nothing more than a four-page summary of the special counsel's report. So that's what I'm saying. That's the next big battle in Washington.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see if that special counsel procedure is changed too in light of this.
Yeah. Now, it was lapsed because people thought that Ken Starr that situation led to Ken Starr overstepping his bounds. It wasn't healthy. Now, one thing about Bill Barr that we should say is he is a strong believer in executive power. He believed this long before Donald Trump came on the scene. He has always believed it. He believes that a president who does something that is within his powers cannot be accused of obstructing justice because he did that. For instance, firing James Comey, which a president can do, the FBI director can be fired by the president, that cannot, according to Bill Barr, it cannot by definition be obstruction because it was a legal act. You know, the critics of the president say, but he fired him in order to stop an investigation into him. But Barr has a different view. And he came by this view honestly. He's held it forever.
Mm-hmm. But okay, I don't want to get into – I don't want to debate that. But I wanted to ask also then, there's been a lot of conversation about charging a sitting president with a crime. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility that the other investigations by like the Southern District of New York, for example, is there a possibility of those things leading to charges?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the difference, and that's why Trump is still in legal peril. He is not going to be – Justice Department policy says you can't indict a sitting president. That is not the policy that governs the Southern District of New York or all the other legal entities that are investigating him for other things, for insurance fraud, for tax fraud, for campaign finance violations, et cetera.
Emoluments.
Yeah. Yes. Those are all separate investigations. They have nothing to do with Russia, which was the subject of the special counsel's investigation, and they are ongoing. And, you know, that's a separate matter altogether, and that is the remaining legal peril for the president.
So we're heading into the 2020 election, which kind of has already kicked off. Is your assignment going to be to follow the campaign, or are you going to stay in D.C.?
I'll do both. I'll be following the campaigns. I'll be going to all the early states, but I'm based in D.C., you know, so I'll be traveling.
Yeah. What about following local political and community issues? Do you ever have – I mean, because we here have a hard time following – well, it's kind of hard not to follow all the national drama.
Right.
But we don't really know the national scene as much as you. Do you ever miss being involved and learning more about the local political thing?
Absolutely. My very first job was for a newspaper in Massachusetts. I covered town selectman meetings, Superior Court. I covered the Bass and Bluefish Derby. You know, I covered school board elections. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I miss that. The one thing about being a national journalist in Washington is you don't know anything about Washington, D.C., local politics, and it's really a shame.
Yeah. Who is covering that? I guess local organizations.
Well, we have a public radio station in Washington, WAMU, and they cover it very, very well. Yeah.
Yeah. How much of what you're doing is being directed by an editor, and how much is completely you?
Oh, geez. I would say that most of it is me, but I do everything with the cooperation, guidance, collaboration of my editor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not like a blank vessel where every morning they say go do this and I go do it. It's a collaborative process. You know, we talk about stories. We think about ways to do stories. I've been blessed by having really great editors, great editors.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been assigned a story in your life that you just really didn't want to do?
That is an excellent question. Probably once or twice I thought, oh, gee, this isn't such a great idea. But you know what? We managed to make it better. It's, you know, it's okay to do some things every so often that you're – that the producers of the show want. Yeah. There was something recently that somebody said, well, we want you to come on the show and talk about the president's tweets. It was like, what do you mean talk about his tweets? Just go through his tweets and talk about them? What? That seemed weird. And my editor felt the same way. So what we did is we took that idea and we molded it into something that we thought was more newsworthy. Well, why don't we take some, you know, what are the big issues of the day and let's talk about what he's tweeting about those. You know, we shaped it. So it was fine.
Yeah. It's always good to take an editor's idea. Yeah. You need to do this. Well, how about if we do it this way? We're going to take a quick break. But when we return, we're going to have more of our conversation with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. If you're just joining us today, I'm joined for the hour by NPR national political correspondent and Fox News contributor Mara Liasson. She stopped by our studio while she's in town to meet with students from FGCU's journalism program to talk about issues surrounding the First Amendment. Liasson was recently named an FGCU Presidential Fellowship Scholar. And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. If you'd like to ask a question about her life as a political journalist, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So we were talking a little bit about the First Amendment and about the polarized kind of journalistic thing. Early on in United States history, the newspapers were kind of governed by who had the money for a printing press in their garage.
Right.
And printed outright lies.
And they were then parties had their own newspapers.
Yeah, parties right. had their newspapers. Yeah. And now they kind of do, maybe?
Well, we certainly are back to an era of more partisan news. You know, like I said, MSNBC and Fox don't even cover the same natural disasters. But you still have a set of news organizations in the middle, and NPR is among them, that strive to be mainstream, fact-based, kind of old-fashioned news organizations where there's a – especially for newspapers, there is a very strong firewall between the op-ed pages and the news pages. I mean, I think the Wall Street Journal was always kind of the pioneer for this and the standard setter, where you got straight news in the news pages, but on you knew what you were getting when you turned to the back of the first section for the editorials and the op-eds.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talk about sometimes here, a lot here, is the culture of journalism that you try to create in a station, not only in the news department, but having everybody who represents the station to uphold that kind of culture of journalism and not go out and opine all the time openly. Do you ever find it difficult to keep your opinion to yourself, even in like personal friend circles?
Well, first of all, I don't keep my opinions to myself in personal friend circles. But I think that it's important. NPR has rules and standards for how we should comport ourselves on social media. We are not allowed to march in a demonstration. If you want to every speech, outside visit, public lecture, et cetera, is approved or disapproved by the ethics officer at NPR. I mean, yeah, you know, there is and there are guidelines for how you should behave on social media. Yeah, I mean, we're all public figures to a certain extent. But that doesn't mean that I don't talk to my own friends
about
Yeah.
And then, you know, fight with some family members. You never know. Do you find, though, that journalists are being held, like, in the last few years to a higher standard than they were before?
That's an excellent question. I think – I don't know if it's that, but I do think what's happened recently, and I think it's unfortunate, is that – you know, in physics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And I think that Trump calling the media enemy of the people, fake news, the opposition party, he has gotten a reaction from some journalists. And there's a lot of controversy about this. And usually it's about the New York Times, that journalists who feel that he is dangerous to the country have to be extremely careful that they don't fall into this trap to become the mirror image, to become the opposition to him. In other words, exactly what he warned about. And the reason why that's so hard is there are norms in this country, and democracy works when there are norms. And I always give this example. It sounds a little silly, but how do you be an objective journalist when Donald Trump stands up at a campaign rally and says, I really want to punch that protester in the face? Is being a balanced journalist going out and interviewing someone who is pro-punching protesters in the face, and then you go interview someone who's anti-punching protesters
in
the
face? Is normalizing this
violence?
Yes,
is normalizing the violence. So how do you report on that fairly while explaining why that is so, against democratic norms, so far out of the mainstream, unprecedented? It's one thing to just, members of Congress, this is a classic reaction, members of Congress, Republicans, members of Congress who privately will talk about how horrified they are at Trump, how disgusted they are at Trump. In public, all they'll say is, well, he's a very unique individual. He has his own way of talking, mm-hmm. Or it's just a tweet.
Yeah.
Look, it's a challenge for everyone.
Well, and it gets to the point, the part of where, when do you call a fact and a non-fact a non-fact?
Mm.
And Joshua Johnson was in town a couple months ago, and we were talking about that. And he said, I will just not entertain the idea that climate change is not real anymore.
Right.
It is a thing. It's
right.
a fact. And
right.
if some – that's not offering another viewpoint.
Right. Right.
When
I
you say
think
it's
that's
not.
Totally – I agree with that 100%. There are some things that are facts. Yes, 99.9% of scientists believe that the globe is warming, climate change is happening, which means more extreme weather, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't mean, that we can't have snow anymore.
Yeah, weather versus climate.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But yes, that is something that I don't think people – just because the president says that that climate change is a Chinese hoax doesn't mean that we should say – we should treat that as a fact. That is pre-Enlightenment thinking. That's saying truth comes from your ruler, not from science, rationality, etc. But it is very hard to have civic discourse if you can't agree on a basic set of facts and then work your way to opinions as opposed to the other way around. You can have an argument about climate change that says climate change is real, it's man-made, and then you can say, you know what? It's not worth doing anything about it because it's too costly. It'll cost too many jobs. We should just mitigate it, put our houses on stilts. And we shouldn't do anything until China and India do, cooperate with us. That's a legitimate reaction. If you say that climate change is a Chinese hoax, then you can't have a discussion about what to do about it at all. And saying that if it's cold in the winter, that means that climate change can't be happening is sort of the same as saying there can't be evolution because we still have monkeys.
Yeah, I see that. I see that. There's a lot of ways to argue it. Is this so difficult to deal, though, when you're talking with maybe a family member or something that has these non-facts, these things that are just not true, and they believe this?
Well, a lot of people use the media for affirmation, not information. And, mm-hmm. Confirmation bias is a thing that people talk about. In other words, any fact that fits into your preconceived worldview, you'll accept as a fact, and everything else you just screen out. And that's really hard. And when we are in a polarized media environment, when we're in a low-trust society, we don't trust the media, and we're being told from the most important person in America that we should not trust the media unless mm-hmm. it's a media that is favorable to him. Who do we believe? Well, we believe the information that comes in from our Facebook friends group, which is where we find out that Obama was born in Kenya and vaccines cause autism. I mean, that's really scary to me.
Yeah, it's kind of these little echo chambers that people are existing in and then finding. Do you see some challenges for young journalism students coming into this kind of an age who've been raised in the last, 4 or 5 years in like the echo chamber of society that we're seeing online?
Well, I do. And I always tell young journalists, I asked today in the class I said, and on where do you get your news? I get it through my Twitter feed. Okay. That means that you have had to choose who you're going to follow. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that you're getting a complete view? I often suggest that people go to news aggregators. There are sites like Real Clear Politics is one of them, where on any given subject of the day, whether it's climate, immigration, the tax bill, you'll get every single thing that's being written from every news organization across the political spectrum, organized for you, and you can click mm-hmm. on anything you want. So you have a chance to get a full comprehensive view. So you're not just in your own little silo. You're not just consuming media that agrees with you. And social media is set up to keep us in silos. We like and friend and follow people who we agree with, and we dislike or block everything else. And we're sorting ourselves out not just in terms of media consumption, but also people tend to live near people who vote like them and worship like them and are educated like them. And, you know, society has sorted itself out. We used to be a more heterogeneous society, and now we're breaking up into homogeneous groups.
Well, one of the things that I always felt really proud about with NPR is that its ethos is to try to be balanced. And still, this perception exists that it's left-leaning. And while audiences are self-sorting into news sources that kind of validate their viewpoints like you're talking about, I worry that not only are these listeners missing the good work that we're putting out, but also political sources on the right are less interested in engaging with us here at the local level. I mean, our state lawmakers are really accessible. But we have a hard time getting the point of view from our Republican U.S. senators and representatives. We can't get them to even respond to emails.
Oh, whoa. We don't have that much trouble at NPR. However, I think what might be the cause of that is not because they say, ooh, you're lefties, I don't want to talk to you. But if they're Republicans, they're maybe thinking, my voters don't listen to you. I'll go on Fox because that's how I can speak to my voters.
Well, they do because they complain whenever we do anything.
Oh,
that they think.
Okay. That's not the case then. Well, anyway, but that's – yeah, I don't know. NPR hasn't had that problem, although there is – you know, there is the problem in Washington of if you want to talk to the president, you go on Fox because that's what he watches, yeah, all day long.
And my very last question, if you weren't reporting, what would you be doing?
Oh, my goodness. That's such a good question. The path not taken for me many, many, many years ago when I just started in journalism and applied to graduate school just in case NPR didn't work out, I applied to urban and regional planning school. And maybe that's what I would have done if I hadn't, if NPR hadn't worked out for me.
Well, it's been so fun talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you
for having
me
on the air.
That's all the time that we have for today's show. My guest, Mara Liasson, is the national political correspondent for NPR and contributor to Fox News, and she's an FGCU Presidential Fellowship Scholar as of today. Mara Liasson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can meet Mara Liasson in person tomorrow from 4 to 6 at the Hilton in Naples. You can find out more about that opportunity on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear all our episodes in their entirety on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.